Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of the Daily Friends Show, the live edition, or at least for those of you watching on YouTube. For those listening on audio, we will be almost live, not quite. I'm joined today by Mr. Herman Pretorius. Herman, how are you?
I'm well, thanks, Nick. It's good to be here. I don't think I've been here in quite a while, so it is good to be back.
Always good to have you with us. It seems as though summer and the heat is here, at least in Cape Town. And from what I hear, Joburg has been hit also with the warmth. And I'm sure much of the country is experiencing proper sort of, although we're not technically in summer, summerish vibes.
Indeed so. Indeed so. It's been a weird time. I mean, we've had a few surprisingly cold days, but I do think that that's behind us now, and that we are now. I mean, I've spent the almost every day of the last week or so trying to get our pool into a sort of a survivable state, just to have something to take off the edge of whatever the heat hits in its full intensity.
This is a phenomenon of like a quintessential global experience, I think, of kind of middle class to upper middle class people, is the eternal battle with one's pool to make sure that it it functions correctly. But
and it's there.
Exactly. Or at least it's not, you know, producing mosquitoes. but let's move on past those cheery subjects to some not so cheery subjects. We haven't talked that much about the day-to-day goings-on of the Matlanga Commission investigating ties between the police and organized crime. But every now and again, sort of bits of news comes up, and I thought this one was particularly galling. Former Police Minister Becky Cele, and before that he was head of the police nationally from the sort of from the police's side, before he was... he was National Police Commissioner. I can't remember his exact position. But anyway, Becky Cele has been very important in the police for a very long time, only recently being replaced by Senzo Machuno and then by Minister Kachalia. And he's before Parliament talking about things related to the allegations made by Lieutenant General Mkhwanazi regarding the disbanding of the Political Killings Task Team. And it has emerged that Becky Cele spent time in the home of attempted murder accused entrepreneur Vusimuzi Matala, or better known as Cat Matala. Now, this is a little bit concerning because Cat Matala, if you begin looking into his sort of history and the allegations against him, has been under investigation multiple times, appears to have enormous influence with various police departments across the country, has been linked to all sorts of bad criminal activity and tendrepreneur scams and all that sort of thing. Feels a lot like he's a kingpin, one might say, of a vast organized crime network. So to have someone who has such close ties to the police service getting free accommodation from Cat Matala, which is apparently what Becky Cele was doing, is not great. Being quizzed by MPs yesterday on this, Becky Cele said that, yes, he did stay at Cat Matala's penthouse in Tswane. Yes, I did stay there. It's nice to sleep for free. I left government in June 2024. Any travel and accommodation arrangements are at my own expense. Mr. Matala offered me the use of his penthouse when I'm in Pretoria. Given that I travel at my own expense, I took up Mr. Matala on his offer. I can confirm that I never visited Mr. Matala's penthouse when I was Minister of Police, and I've only visited his penthouse on two occasions. He said that I can confirm further that when I was residing at Matala's place, I did not know of all the allegations that have now come to the surface. He claimed that his police raided his property on the 6th of December, and that's all I knew. He then also said that he wasn't friends with Cat Matala, that he was simply... an acquaintance of his, and various MPs were asking him questions about this. In fact, even an ANC MP asked him, well, why did you feel comfortable sleeping at a stranger's house? Becky Cele said, no, I took it. I'm not in government. Herman, I mean, you know, there's so much that's coming out of these commissions, and this one is a particularly kind of gobsmacking sort of response, but it's becoming clearer and clearer just, I think, how close the relationship between a lot of very dodgy characters and the senior leadership of the police is. What's your take on this one?
No, it is rather extraordinary in the sense that the judgment being that I'm no longer in government, and that was literally the only thing that was preventing me from associating with, you know, someone of Matlala's reputation and alleged links to the underworld. I mean, that is quite extraordinary and revealing in the sense that if it was only being in government that prevented Becky Kele from an absolutely full immersion into the sort of the criminal underworld, then my word, praise be to the moral power of government. But the further problem is, of course, that it is incredible that Becky Kele could expect people to believe what he says, that he acknowledges an intense presence of smoke and then seeks to deny the logical conclusion of fire. And there's also a problem that this is a man still in the management or in the top leadership of the ANC. He's a member of the ANC's National Executive Committee. His party is in government. He is active in terms of the ANC's decision making. It really just shows to the extent that there is an appreciation among in the ANC for, you know, a separation of interest between being in government and not. It really just shows that that extent isn't very far, that you can indulge and enjoy all the perks of connections, and, you know, you can plead poverty so that you can sleep in the penthouse of a known scumbag. As long as you're not in government, you could be absolutely associated with all the powers of government. You can actually sort of be one of the most powerful people within the ANC, as long as you're not formally a salaried or government.
You know, it's kind of difficult to believe that anyone could just sort of innocently take an offer like that. It's like a businessman who, according to Kele's own version, doesn't, you know, he's not really acquainted with, he's not friends with, is just offering him these sort of free benefits out of the goodness of his heart. I mean, I wonder why he's doing that. Maybe he's just such a nice guy.
Yeah. It immediately reminded me of two instances. One was the spider scandal in the Kruger government, when about 20 or so members of parliament in the Zuid-Afrikaanse Republiek were suddenly the recipients of a few spider vehicles, one of the first motorized personal vehicles to make it in South Africa, from a French business person who happened to receive some tenders and contracts from the government in the Republic. And these 20 or so MPs who received these vehicles happened to vote in favor of that contractual awarding. And then then Bolkrier sort of defended that and said, these people work hard. There's nothing in the law that says they can't accept gifts. And then we're like, okay, fine. So that's the first thing it reminded me of, is just the fantastic naivety of Bolkrier. And the other one was sort of Prince Andrew. His whole thing with the reason he stayed in Jeffrey Epstein's house in New York is he was too honorable. He was a bit too honorable. He didn't want to ruffle feathers. It was a convenient place to stay. I mean, it really just illustrates the out of touchness that the elite seemed to enjoy. And Minister Kele says this all with a straight face, with utter bombast. And yeah, no, it is a beautiful study in out of touchness. I don't think we should hold our breath for any true consequences, but it is rather amazing how one can just experience the psychological detachment that these people seem to operate under, and there's no self-awareness. And I must say, it is revealing and entertaining and depressing and all of those things at once.
You know, I kind of we're getting already to that point where, I mean, look, if you've been paying attention to these issues and you've been reading knowledgeable accounts and investigative journalism and stuff, it's been pretty clear for a while that you know these sort of very dodgy links between organized crime, the ANC, police, all these things have been in existence for many years. But now they're coming out in a very sort of public and gruesome way, and we're seeing exactly, you know, how some of these things worked, and everyone is throwing out allegations at everyone else. And, you know, obviously most South Africans are not following this day by day. Most South Africans just generally don't follow the news, and also, you know, there's just so much and there's just so many details that I think, you know, even those who follow the news are, for the most part, probably not following the blow by blow. But eventually, I think the impression that people are going to get from all of this is that the state's legitimacy as a sort of keeper of law and order will be utterly and completely shot. And that is the kind of thing that creates gigantic crises that are often, I think, unpredictable. You know, when people basically just decide that the government has sort of no legitimacy. I don't know, Herman. Am I exaggerating, or what do you think could be the potential downstream consequences of this?
Not at all. I don't think you're exaggerating. For context, the expenses scandal in the UK in 2009, or that it started in 2009, was probably the most damaging political scandal in the UK for 50 years. It wasn't a scandal of terrible size necessarily. The damage to the public purse wasn't enormous. It was substantive, but it really, really was manageable form. But what was broken and hasn't been repaired for about 2 decades since was the basic sense of trust that survived into the 21st century in this idea of politicians actually being in politics for the right reasons. And it's the same with Watergate. Watergate was the moment that a large dose of cynicism flooded the bloodstream of the body politic and the blood body civic in America, and it changed the perception of why people enter politics. Now, politics has never been a
And just
terribly
on that
honorable
point,
pursuit.
it had this very long tail, the Watergate thing in the US. It's kind of a turning point at which Americans basically continuously lose trust in their institutions from that point until the modern day, where they're at sort of historic lows. So these
Exactly.
things
No,
have very big
precisely.
ripple effects.
Yes. And whether they ought to have bigger ripple effects, whether we should be, suspicious or cynical about power, the reality is that these events truly shape the identity of our of important institutions. And it minimizes the appeal, the esteem of public service, of politics. And politics has never been sort of always a purely noble pursuit, but it will be incredibly damaging if there's no nobility left in it, because then you won't attract any decent people to stand for public office. It'll just be a negative and a destructive spiral. Now, South Africa, I think, hasn't had a wonderful track record of cynical free politics. We've had our own special scandals of distrust. But if we were to look at our sort of post-94 process and start from the arms deal. Actually, start from the Sarafina disaster, where you know money was just shamelessly funneled and stolen, and the arms deal, and on to state capture, and now it's just become sort of baked into the system. We don't have a lot of goodwill. We don't have a lot of positive resources or, you know, credit in that bank balance. We really do need everything we can get for our politics to have a sliver of esteem and nobility for decent people to enter it. And I'm not trying to hype up politics. It's just if good people absolutely sort of just dismiss politics, then all that will remain of politics is a grubby little stitch up permanently. So we have this here, and the out of touchness it indicates, the selfishness it indicates, the level of personal gain that seems acceptable within the political system that really eroded whatever trust there might have been in British politics in terms of the expenses scandal. And now just this being part and parcel, this sort of entitlement. And also this rather disgusting picture of Bheki Cele pleading poverty. I think that's part of what really does sort of disgust me the most about this, is he's genuinely pretending that he is a poor man who needs every act of charity he can get, even from someone as dubious as Khatmatlala, otherwise he won't be able to make it. That is a sense of entitlement and the sense of self-preservation and just a sense of unreality that is remarkable and that does great damage to our politics.
I think, you know, we're going to see over the next few months and maybe even a few years the sort of kind of scope and impact of all of this leaching out. And, you know, most South Africans in not too far in the future will, I think, have a general idea of what has been going on at the Matlanga Commission and Mkhwanazi. I mean, Mkhwanazi's already made a big splash on social media, but the sort of more, the vibes of all of this are going to kind of leach out to even people who don't pay attention to the news. And it's going to create a legitimacy crisis. And at that point, you know, I think you kind of do create a real space in which rapid political change can happen. In what direction, I think it's very difficult to tell. But when something unexpected next happens in our politics in a big way, I think, obviously there'll be many streams feeding into that river. But this is going to be a very big tributary. Let's just put it that way.
And perhaps the last thing on this topic. The 2024 elections changed one thing fundamentally, and that is that it broke the dominance party stasis in terms of political talent. And this is something that we've discussed before, but there's some solid research indicating that in single dominant party systems, the talent pool really shallows out because the party in power, the dominant party, feels no pressure to innovate, to recruit, to renew, to attract new talent. So it becomes a very much a gatekeeping situation. So you do end up with a dearth of talent. And I think the ANC is a very, very good example of that. If you compare the caliber of politician that went to parliament for the ANC in 1994 and you compare it to what they have today, it's chalk and cheese, in the sense that the 1994 intake had, whether you like them or not, there was some real talent and seriousness there. Even as recently as Polokwane 2007, you had people like Joel Netshitenze being, you know, on the almost getting elected Secretary General. Now, I think Joel Netshitenze is a horrible thinker, but he's a thinker. He's a person of substance. So on the one hand, the ANC has run out of serious politicians. And over the same period, it has been incredibly difficult for opposition parties to attract people of credibility and weight. And that's part of the dominant party problem is if you're in government, you run out of incentives to attract new talent. And if you're in opposition, you have no capacity to attract new talent because who would leave a comfortable or a successful career or retirement to only come and sit in the opposition benches for 5 years? So what's really useful about the 2024 election is that that dominance is gone. There is now a route for someone to take the Leon Schreiber trajectory, to go from academics through to politics to government. I mean, 10 years ago, Leon Schreiber was an academic. Something that has happened is that the gene pool from where South Africa's politicians can be drawn has sort of been inched bigger by last year's elections. And it is precisely at this moment when we would actually, as a country, appreciate a flood in of new political talent from people of substance. And then at this very moment, you have this sort of nonsense from Becky Taylor that just diminishes that opportunity of getting people of substance and esteem to step into politics. And then you've got someone like this man just showing what South African politics is. And it doesn't help the country at all in terms of making use of the moment to understand, you know, politics doesn't have to be the grubby Becky Taylor Cat Matlala sort of idiocy. And I see Robert Brain say, please, not academics. I mean, that's just ignorant. I mean, someone like Ludwig Erhard, probably the greatest minister of economics of the 20th century, was a pure academic. Not all academics are decent, but to think that academics can't actually have good ideas is just to entertain caricature and not seriousness.
All right, let's move on to teaching in South Africa. There's been a survey of South African teachers, the Teaching and Learning International Survey, which is undertaken by the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development. And they survey countries around the world. South Africa is one of them. The results of the survey were released yesterday on Thursday, and it found that more than half of South African teachers who participated in the survey believed that everyone has a certain amount of intelligence and no one can really do much to change it. This was apparently the view held by about 51% of teachers. Now, Herman, you know, I've read people, this is like a favorite topic of people to argue about online sometimes, is you know, what is intelligence? Or people say, oh, IQ, EQ, intelligence means this. And I think that stuff all gets very silly and academic. I will say, though, that if you're going into teaching with the assumption that sort of you're basically just not going to be able to do much for most of your students, doesn't seem like great foundation or attitude to have as a teacher. What's your take on this one?
No, I think that's why I'm so glad that we include this in the discussion, because whether it's true or not, the fact that teachers have, or that a majority, 58.1% of teachers in South Africa, seem to have this deterministic idea of, yep, well, kids in my class either have it or not. I'll do what I can for the idiots, but, you know, let's hope the good ones get somewhere in their life. It really, really just depresses in terms of what are these teachers then actually trying to do. And what's worse is it doesn't seem to be the case that that knowledge is or intelligence is that strictly defined. There seems to be a remarkable fluidity in terms of intelligence. And if one just appreciates intelligence to be, essentially based on neuroplasticity, then the very notion of set intelligence is frankly a pre-modern idea. The problem is that we know sources of impact in terms of intelligence ranges from nutrition, exposure, mentorship, emotional health. It really is a mixed bag, and all of the above sort of approach that, in terms of making sure a child has the best chance possible, there are many, many levers that could be pulled and positioned to ensure a kid has something of a brighter future than the one that they deterministically have to face. So even if that were not the case, which to my mind seems to be the case, that intelligence is actually something that has some elasticity to it and has some liquidity, it is utterly depressing that the majority of teachers just clearly don't understand that their job is to do the best they can for children and then sort of get them an intellectual buoyancy, or at least discover their talent. I hate the quote of Albert Einstein of you know, what's intelligence and what asking a fish to climb a tree. You know, it I think it gets used to cheapen serious discussion about what is intelligence. But there is truth in that. That the part of the education system should be to understand what is someone's God-given talents and how could that be developed and improved and expanded. So if the assumption is that intelligence is sort of a fixed pie, ah, my word, what a depressing situation. And really, it explains to a very large extent why we get this fatalism and this sort of passive fatalism from our teaching unions in a large degree. Is we can't do much. We can only be here and sort of, you know, it minimizes the impact, so it minimizes the responsibility. And that is, I think, more than the Cat Matlala story. This is a depressing take from people who should be, you know, optimists and really invested in getting that benefit of teaching and talent to every kid who passes through our schools. And I can tell you now, if we were in a situation where we polled parents about the intelligence of their kids, we would get a different answer. Every parent wants to believe, well, not every parent, but I'm pretty sure
most
vast majority of parents will want to believe that their child has talent and an ability to grow and deliver. And that is why whenever people ask who should be in control of the education system, the short answer is the people who actually believe that those people in the system, those kids in the system, is worth it. And that's 9 out of 10 cases. It's the parents.
Yeah, I think anyone who's ever had a truly great teacher, and they are rare, during one's primary and high school education, it leaves impacts on you, and it often can shape your life in interesting ways. You know, you do discover things about how you want to move forward in your life and what you're good at or what really interests you. You know, that life, that stuff can really come alive for you. And so, you know, if your teachers, if more than half of your teachers are going in with the impression that, well, you know, we'll house you and make sure you can pass the exam, but that's about as good as it's going to be. It's just robbing potential, from kids. Okay. Let's move on to our last story.
Can I just say one thing? And it does reflect on what the bloody hell are teachers learning in their qualifications.
That's another whole thing too. I mean, you know, about how well qualified are South Africa's teachers? What are the ones who are qualified being taught?
And Evan, and if your job is to teach a child, but you don't really believe children are teachable, what have you been taught in terms of what is information, what is knowledge, what is insight, what is data, all of those relatively complex psychological factors that go into the transfer of, you know, skills and the upskilling of young minds. It really asks the question as to whether our teaching colleges are just, these sausage machines that just sort of pumps out people who sort of can tick the boxes of teaching. And that's one of the things that I'm actually quite excited, fatalistically almost so, about for AI and the impact of AI on education, is the concept of what qualifies as knowledge and skill and insight and understanding will change, and teachers will have to change with it to actually get back to a state of actual assessment of educational impact, and not just assessments, assignments, or tests, or these things that have become sort of such a shorthand and a shortcut to knowledge. And in that ex to that extent, let a billion blossoms bloom. Let schools start up and compete for the best way to measure intelligence, understanding, and educational impact.
Look at you, sir, it, outing yourself as a techno-optimist. Why I never, but let's move on to our next topic. We've talked quite a few times on the show about the character of Floyd Brink, former city manager in the city of Johannesburg, removed twice from his position for various reasons by courts, and a guy who, let's just say, hasn't had a great track record as the chief bureaucrat in the city of Johannesburg. Well, we talked, I think, quite recently, last time even you were on the show, Herman, about how there was a leak that Floyd Brink was likely going to be recommended as the next city manager by a panel set up by the ANC coalition government in Joburg. And to no one's surprise, said panel, in fact, did propose that Floyd Brink be reappointed. But it seems as though even within the ANC and its coalition, not all is happy clappy on that front. Council was supposed to debate yesterday this proposal, but it was removed from the agenda. And according to the reporting, there is discontent. In fact, there are some in the ANC who are pushing for Johannesburg property company CEO Helen Boeters to take up the role instead, which, shall we say, is not a great alternative. Helen Boeters has a cloud over her over various things. Excuse me. So, yeah, I think really, Herman, what this kind of just shows is once again this problem of how the ANC just seems to have absolutely no ability to even pretend like it's serious about turning things around in Joburg. We've just got to appoint the same people who've been there forever, and if there's unhappiness about that, it's only because we're fighting about which particular person with a bad track record we're going to appoint.
Yes, and what people should understand about local government, is that the system is designed quite deliberately for the political leadership of the city to be the board. So you've got the mayor, who is sort of chairman of the board of directors of the company that is the local government. So they represent the shareholder interests, the voters, and the residents. And then you've got the city manager or the municipal manager, and they are like the CEO. They are in charge of functions, daily functions, and the running of the business. So the idea that we can look at a company that is, if Joburg were a company, it would have been on the tail end of a rather crap decade. A decade during which one person was either CEO or acting CEO. And then the contention would be to bring him back as CEO. Now, that is what Floyd Brink is essentially in the position in. He was the municipal manager for most of the last decade, either in sort of temporary acting or full capacity. He's been a disaster in the sense that the city has fallen apart. And now the ANC is sort of torn between keeping this man and appointing a woman who sort of seems to attract clouds of corruption wherever she goes. She Helen Boetes is, of course, the former chief of or the former boss of the Johannesburg property company that, you know, had some significant questions asked about her tenure. And it's just remarkable that even as deep in the excrement puddle as Joburg currently is, the ANC cannot bring itself to consider a new CEO, to consider someone who might actually get the job done.
The classic move by cynical politicians, right, is you pretend just before the election you're gonna fix the problem, so you appoint someone good or whatever, and then after you've managed to hang on in the election, you just do whatever you were planning to do before. But we're not even reaching that level.
No, we are literally at the level of seeing Johannesburg's ANC go. Let's keep in place the person whose job it was to run the city successfully over the last decade. Has it been a success over the last decade? No, but that's not important. Let's keep in place the person whose job it was to run the city over the past decade. And it is remarkable. It is an insult to voters. And I really feel for Joburg that Action SA, the ACDP, sabotaged Joburg's chance to appoint someone like Johan Mettler, civil servant and you know, city manager of serious substance and quality. So yeah, sorry guys, that's Johannesburg, that was Action SA and the ACDP for you.
Yeah, no, and it's why you know, normally I'd say, well, you know, I'm kind of much warmer to you know, sort of opposition coalition taking over cities like Joburg. Back in 2016, you know, I was in the DA and I wouldn't say I was happy with, but I was sort of open to the idea that being in this kind of half-baked coalition with the EFF would maybe work out okay. Subsequently, the last 10 years have really crushed any notion, I think, that's a reasonable idea. You know, you actually need to have parties that sort of oppose the ANC, sort of on real grounds. You need to yes. Actually, you know, when when the ANC and EFF say, hey, we want to reappoint the city manager who's been, you know, had done a really bad job so far, you don't take it as an opportunity to politically grandstand and bash the DA over it, because as we see now in Joburg, that really didn't help anyone, did it? Didn't help Action SA, didn't help the DA, didn't really even help the ANC, probably. It was an amazing lose-lose for everyone, except perhaps Floyd Brink's employment prospects. just, you know, a really awful part of local politics in South Africa, that whole episode was.
Yeah.
Okay. What should we do? I think let's close it there for today. We are over the half an hour mark, so we won't bore you too much. Thank you very much, everyone, for listening. We hope you found the show interesting today. We will be back, of course, on Monday. Have a wonderful weekend. We'll see you all on Monday on The Daily Friend Show. Cheers, everyone.